or so. I take out my phone and scroll through my blog feed. Then he says, "Hey, what are you up to on Saturday?"
Nothing, I guess.
"Do you... We should do something."
"We should?"
"Yeah."
Now he's embarrassed.
"I mean, if you want."
"Like what?"
He shakes his head.
"I don't know. Just
chill somewhere."
I force myself to think very carefully about this. I could try, for once. I could try to be a legitimately nice human being.
"Oh, I said I'd go to this thing in the evening, but I'm free in the day."
He lights up.
"Great, what do you want to do?"
"I don't know, it was your idea."
"Oh, yeah, well, you could come round mine if you want, just watch movies."
"Is Evelyn all right with that?"
"Yep, I went there."
He sort of laughs, like I'm joking.
"What? Evelyn?"
My voice starts to fail.
"Are you not...
You and Evelyn...
We're...
No."
"Okay, right.
Cool, just checking."
"What are you guys talking about?"
Becky calls over to us. We both spin around in our chairs.
"You look like you're talking about something interesting."
"I want gossip. Spill."
I put my legs up on Lucas's lap because I just can't be arsed to be reserved right now. "Obviously we're flirting. God, Becky."
For a second, Becky thinks I'm serious. It is a truly triumphant moment. Later, I pass Michael in the corridor. He stops and points directly at me.
"You,"
he says.
"Me,"
I say. We speedily transfer our conversation to a stairwell.
"Are you free on Saturday?"
he asks. He's got one of his stupid mugs of tea again. He's actually spilt some on his white shirt. I'm about to say yes, but then I remember.
No, I said me and Lucas would do something. Sorry.
"Ah, don't worry." He sips his tea. "You're not allowed to ditch the solitaire meetup, though."
"Oh. You forgot, didn't you? I'm surprised you remembered."
"Well, everyone's been talking about it."
"They have?"
We look at each other.
"Do I have to go?"
I say. "You are aware that I literally don't give a single fuck about solitaire."
"I am aware,"
he says, which means, yes, I do have to go. The horde of lower school girls thundering up the stairs behind us is slowly thinning. I need to get to English.
"Anyway," he says,
"yes, get to mine Saturday evening. When you and Lucas are finished canoodling..." He moves his eyebrows up and down. I slowly shake my head. I don't think I have ever heard anyone use that word in real life.
"Well then," he says, "I'm glad I've made your day that bit more special."
Chapter 23. In my younger years, every day after school, I used to walk down the road and meet Charlie outside Truham. We'd then either ride the bus home or we would walk. Despite it only being a 10-minute bus journey, I would have to put my iPod on near full volume. I knew that I would be deaf by the time I was 20, but if I had to listen to these kids every single day, I don't think I'd make it to 20. I don't think I'd make it to 17. Still, despite my 2-year-long bus boycott, I started getting the bus again on Wednesday to keep Charlie company. And it hasn't been too bad so far. We've had a good chance to talk about stuff. I don't mind talking with Charlie. Anyway, it's Friday today and Michael has decided that he is coming home with me. Which is sort of nice, to tell you the truth. Nick is waiting for me outside Truham. Nick always looks particularly dashing in his tie and blazer. The rugby patch above his school crest reflects a little sunlight. He is wearing sunglasses, Ray-Bans. He sees Michael and me approach.
Right?
Nick nods, hands in pockets, Adidas bag strapped across his chest.
All right, I say.
Nick studies Michael.
Michael Holden, he says.
Michael has his hands held behind his back.
You're Nick Nelson.
I see Nick's initial uncertainty ease at Michael's uncharacteristically normal reaction.
Yep. Yeah, I remember you. From Truham. You're infamous, man.
Yes. Yeah, I'm awesome.
Rad.
Michael smiles. Nicholas Nelson. You have a really excellent name. Nick laughs in that warm way of his, almost as if he and Michael have been friends for years.
I know, right?
Flocks of Truham boys soar past us, running for inexplicable reasons, while the traffic on the road is unmoving. A group of Year 10 Higgs girls cozy up to a group of Year 10 Truham boys against the gate several metres away from us. There are at least three couples within the group.
God.
I scratch my forehead, feeling agitated. Where's Charlie? Nick raises his eyebrows and turns back toward Truham.
He's the only guy in his class who cares about classics, so he's probably been dragged into a long conversation with Rogers about, like, Greek proverbs or something.
Tori! I twirl around. Becky is dodging traffic and skipping my way, her purple locks flailing behind her. When she arrives, she says, Ben said he had to go to Truham and get something from last year, coursework or something, so I'm just going to wait with you guys. I don't want to stand by myself like a Larry. I smile. It's starting to become really difficult to do that sometimes around Becky, but I make the effort and force it. Michael and Nick are both staring at her with empty expressions that I can't read.
What are you all doing here?
We're waiting for Charlie, I say.
Oh, yeah?
Shall we just go in and find him? Nick suggests. He's being majorly slow. But none of us moves.
It's like we're in Waiting for Godot, murmurs Michael.
I've heard of the play, but I haven't got any idea what Michael is talking about. And as if things could not get any more awkward, Lucas appears out of nowhere. Nick raises his arms.
Lucas, mate!
They embrace in a manly sort of hug, but Lucas just looks silly. They proceed to exchange pleasantries, and each of them uses the words mate and man far too many times, resulting in Michael snorting,
Oh my God,
much too loudly. Fortunately, Lucas and Nick appear not to hear. I chuckle faintly.
What are you all doing here?
Asks Lucas, deliberately pretending not to see Michael.
Waiting for Charlie, says Nick.
Waiting for Ben, says Becky.
Why don't you just go look for them? I've got to go inside too, to pick up my art GCSE coursework.
That's what Ben's doing, says Becky.
At the repeated mention of Ben, Nick seems to frown at Becky. But I might just be imagining it.
Well, let's go then, he says, and pushes his sunglasses farther up his nose.
We can't, whispers Michael, oozing sarcasm, so quiet that only I hear.
Why not? We're waiting for Charlie. Ah.
He might be quoting, but I haven't read or seen Waiting for Godot, so it's lost on me. Nick turns on the spot and walks into the school. Becky follows immediately, then the rest of us. I remember instantly why I chose not to go to this school for sixth form. The boys who pass us are more than strangers. I feel trapped. As we enter the main building, the walls seem to creep higher and higher, and the light bars are dim and flashing, and I experience a brief flashback of the back of Michael's head, leading me toward the Truham Maths classroom last year. Every so often, we pass these rusty old radiators,
none of which appears to be emitting any heat. I start to shiver.
God, it's like an abandoned mental asylum, isn't it?
Michael is on my left.
I'd forgotten what it's like here. It's as if they built it out of misery.
We wind through corridors that appear to materialize in front of our feet. Michael starts whistling. Truam boys give us a lot of funny looks, particularly Michael. One group of older boys shout,
"Oi, Michael Holden, wanker!"
And Michael spins on the spot and produces a strong double thumbs up in their direction. We pass through a set of double doors and find ourselves in a large maze of lockers, not unlike our own Higgs locker room. It seems empty at first, until we hear a voice.
"What the fuck did you say to them?"
All five of us freeze.
The voice continues. "Because I don't remember saying that you could spread lies about me to your retard sister."
Whoever else is there murmurs something inaudible. I already know who it is. I think everyone already knows who it is. I spot Becky's face. I haven't seen that expression on her for a very long time.
"Do not make me laugh. I bet you couldn't wait to run and tell someone. Everyone knows you're just an attention-seeking prick. Everyone knows you're doing it for the attention, and you're telling your sister lies about us so she can spread shit around. You think you're so much better than everyone because you don't eat, and now you're back at school, and even though you haven't even looked at me since you hooked up with that rugby gay, you think you can spread shit about me that isn't even fucking true."
"I don't know what you think you've heard," says Charlie, louder now, "but I literally haven't told anyone. Anyway, I seriously can't believe you're still terrified of people finding out." There is a sharp smack and a crash. I start running toward the voices before I realize what I'm doing, and I turn the corner of a locker row and Charlie is crumpled on the floor. Ben Hope is in some kind of rage, just hitting Charlie's face, and there's blood, and Nick tackles Ben in his side and the pair topples down the row and into the wall at the end. And I'm kneeling down by Charlie and I'm holding my hands up by his face, not daring to touch him. But his eyes are barely open and I think I'm shaking and everything seems a bit, I don't know. And Nick is screaming, "I'll kill you," over and over. And then Michael and Lucas are dragging Nick away, and I'm still just sort of sitting there with my little brother, with my shaking hands, wishing that I hadn't woken up this morning. I hadn't woken up yesterday. I hadn't ever woken up.
"That dick deserves it," Ben shouts, panting. "He's a fucking liar."
"He didn't even say anything to me," I say, calm at first. Then I'm screaming it.
"He didn't even say anything to me!"
Everyone is silent. Ben is breathing heavily. What I thought was attractive about him has now died and been cremated. Michael kneels down with me, leaving Nick in the care of Lucas. He clicks his fingers lightly next to Charlie's ear. Charlie stirs and his eyes open.
"Do you know my name?" asks Michael. Not Michael anymore, someone entirely different, someone serious, someone all-knowing. After a pause, Charlie croaks, "Michael Holden." Then he grins manically.
"Holden, funny." Something changes in Nick, and in one swift movement, he's down on the floor with us. He takes Charlie into his arms.
"Do we need to take him to hospital? What hurts?"
Charlie lifts his hand, waves a finger at his face, then drops it.
"I think I'm fine."
"Maybe he's concussed," says Nick.
"I don't want to go to the hospital," says Charlie firmly. His eyes have focused.
I look around. Becky appears to have vanished, and Ben is struggling to his feet, and Lucas doesn't seem to know what to do with himself. Charlie stands up surprisingly quickly. He wipes away a smear of blood. He'll have bruises, but at least his nose is still straight. He looks at Ben. Ben looks back. And that's when I see it in Ben's eyes. Fear. I'm not going to tell, says Charlie, because I'm not a dick like you. Ben snorts, but Charlie ignores it. But I think that you should at least try and be honest with yourself, even if you can't be honest with everyone else. It's just sad, you know? Get away from me, Ben snarls, but his voice wobbles, sort of like he's on the verge of tears. Just fuck off with your boyfriend, for fuck's sake. Nick very nearly lunges for the second time, but I see him fight to stop himself. Ben catches my eye as we leave. I stare at him and his expression changes from hatred to what I hope might be regret. I doubt it. I want to be sick. I try to think of something to say to him, but nothing summarizes it. I hope I'm making him want to die. Someone places a hand around my arm and I turn my head. Come on, Tori, says Lucas. So I do. On our way out, Lucas with a hand on my back, Nick and Michael supporting Charlie, who is still a bit wobbly, we pass Becky, who has for some reason pushed herself to the end of another locker row. We lock eyes. I know she's going to break up with Ben. She has to break up with Ben. She must have heard everything. She's my best friend. Charlie is my brother. I don't understand what has happened. Should we feel sorry for Ben? Someone asks. Maybe Michael. Why are there no happy people? Someone else asks. Maybe me. Chapter 24. Someone calls me on my mobile at 9:04 a.m., but I am in bed and my phone is more than an arm's length away, so I just let it ring on. At 9:15 a.m., someone rings the house phone and Charlie comes into my room, but I keep my eyes closed and pretend I'm still asleep, and Charlie goes away. My bed whispers at me to stay. My curtains bar out daytime. At 2:34 p.m., Dad throws my door open and huffs and mutters and I suddenly feel sick. So after another 5 minutes, I go downstairs and sit on the sofa in the living room. Mum comes in to get some washing. Are you going to get dressed? She asks. No, Mum. I'm never going to get dressed ever again. I'm going to live in my pyjamas until my death. She doesn't say anything else. She leaves. Dad comes into the living room. Alive, then? I say nothing, because I do not feel alive. Dad sits next to me. Are you going to tell me what's wrong? No, I am not. You know, if you want to be happier, you have to try. You have to put in the effort. Your problem is that you don't try. I do try. I have tried. I have tried for 16 years. Where's Charlie? I ask. Round Nick's. Dad shakes his head. Still can't believe Charlie got himself hit in the face with a cricket bat. That kid really does attract misfortune. I do not say anything. Are you going to go out today? No. Why not? What about Michael? You could spend the day with him again. I don't really reply, and Dad looks at me. What about Becky? I haven't seen her around here for quite a while. I don't reply again. He sighs and rolls his eyes. Teenagers, he says, as if the mere state of being a teenager explains every single thing about me. And then he leaves, huffing and puffing and sighing. I sit under my duvet on my bed, a diet lemonade in one hand and my phone in the other. I find Michael's number in my contacts and press the green button. I don't know why I'm calling him.
I think it might be Dad's fault.
It goes straight to voicemail. I drop the phone on the bed and roll over, so I am completely buried by the covers. Of course I can't expect him to just show up any old time. He has a life after all. He has a family and coursework and stuff. His entire existence doesn't revolve around mine. I am a narcissist. I rummage around the sheets and eventually locate my laptop. I flip it up. If ever in doubt about anything, my first port of call is always Google. And I am certainly in doubt about everything. I type Michael Holden into the search bar and press enter. Michael Holden isn't an overly uncommon name. Lots of other Michael Holdens show up, particularly MySpace pages. Since when was MySpace still a thing? Lots of Twitters also show up. But I can't find my Michael Holden's Twitter. He doesn't seem to be the sort of guy who would have Twitter. I sigh and close my laptop. At least I tried. And then, as if I'd summoned him with the closing of my laptop, my phone begins to ring. I pick it up. Michael Holden's name glares on the screen. With a kind of enthusiasm entirely unknown to me, I press the green button. Hello? Tori, what is up? It seems to take me longer than necessary to say something in reply. Not a lot. Behind Michael's voice, the low chatter of a crowd can be heard. Where are you? I ask. What's happening? This time, it is he who pauses. Oh, yeah, I didn't tell you, did I? I'm at the rink. Oh, do you have practice or something? No, it's, I've got a sort of competition today.
A competition?
Yeah.
What competition?
He pauses again. It's the National Youth Speed Skating Semifinals. My stomach gives up. Look, I've got to go. I promise I'll call you when it's finished, yeah? And then I'll see you tonight.
Yeah.
Okay, talk later. He hangs up the phone. I remove it from my ear and stare at it. National Youth Speed Skating Semifinals. That's not just some stupid local competition. That's important. That's what he was going to invite me to today, but I'd said no. I'd said I was hanging out with Lucas. And then I decided to avoid him anyway. Without any further hesitation, I leap out of bed. I park Charlie's bike outside the rink. It's 4:32 p.m. and dark. I've probably missed it. I don't know why I even tried, but I did. How long are speed skate races? Why didn't Michael tell me about this before? I run, yes, actually run, through the empty foyer and the double doors into the stadium. A scattering of supporters fills the stadium seating around the rink. And to my right, psyched-up skaters sit on benches. Some of them could be 16. Some could be 25. I am not good at judging boys' ages. I walk closer to the plastic casing of the rink and make my way around until I find the gate where the casing isn't so high. I stare over. There is a race going on. For a moment, I don't know where I'm looking or who I'm looking for. Because they all look exactly the same in these ridiculous suits that are like cat suits and rounded helmets. 8 guys blast past me, and the rush of air tears at my face and my hair that I definitely forgot to sort out before I left the house. And they lean round the corners of the rink, so close to the ice, brushing it with their fingertips. I don't understand how they don't just fall over. When they pass me the second time, that's when I see him. He turns his head, showing me his bulbous eyes behind large goggles and a ridiculously concrete expression. The eyes find me and his body turns, his hair swept backward, and his face, beyond surprised, stays parallel to mine. I know instantly that something has changed. He stares. At me, maybe. His whole face expands. It illuminates, and all else seems to fade into fog. And I place a hand against the plastic casing, and everything inside me rushes to my feet. I'm not sure if he really sees me. I don't cheer. I just stand there. He pulls out in front. The crowd screams, but then some other blare of boy flies from the group, and he's reached Michael, and he's past Michael, and I realize that the race is over and Michael has come second. I back away from the rink and shelter myself slightly behind the stands as the skaters make their way to the gate. Older men in tracksuits greet the boys, and one of them pats Michael on the back. But something is wrong. Something is very wrong. Something about Michael is wrong. He's not Michael Holden. He's removed his skates and goggles. He takes off his helmet and gloves and drops them onto the floor. His face contorts into a kind of scrunched up snarl. His fists curl so his skin drains of colour. And he storms past the man and tramps over to the benches. He reaches a row of lockers and looks into them, blankly, chest visibly expanding and contracting. With an almost terrifying malice, he throws a crazed punch at the lockers, wailing a subdued howl of rage. Turning, he hurls a kick at a pile of racing helmets, scattering them about the floor. He clutches his hair, as if trying to pull it out. I've never seen Michael like this. I know I shouldn't be so surprised. I haven't even known Michael for 3 weeks. But my perceptions of people rarely change. And when they do, it's never this drastic. It's weird how you see someone who smiles all the time and you assume that they are happy all the time. It's weird how someone is nice to you and you assume that they're a wholly good person. I did not think Michael could be so serious about something, or so angry. It's like watching your dad cry. What scares me the most, though, is that absolutely no person in this entire swarm of human beings seems to notice. So I barge my way toward him. I'm furious. I hate all these people for not caring. I'm hurling them out of the way as I walk, Michael Holden never leaving my eyesight. I reach him, breaking out of the crowd, and watch as he begins to manically attack some piece of paper that he had in his pocket. For several seconds, I don't really know what to do about it. But then find myself saying, "Yes, Michael Holden, tear that fucking paper." He drops everything, spins around, and points directly at me. The anger softens into sadness. "Tori," he says, but I don't hear it. I only see his mouth form the words. He's wearing a catsuit, and he's quite red, and his hair is slick with sweat, and his eyes are spinning in an electrified fury. But it's him. Neither of us really knows what to say. "You came second," I blurt eventually, pointlessly. "That's amazing." His expression, passive, sad, so odd, doesn't change. He retrieves his glasses from his pocket and puts them on. "I didn't win," he says. "I didn't qualify." He looks away. I think he's welling up a little. "I didn't think you were actually here," he says. "I thought I'd imagined you." A pause. "That's the first time you've called me Michael Holden." His chest is still moving quickly up and down. He looks older somehow in the spandex suit, and taller. The suit is mostly red, with some orange and black areas. He has a whole life that I don't know about in this suit. Hundreds of hours on the ice, training,
entering competitions, testing his stamina, trying to eat right.
I don't know about any of that. I want to know.
I open my mouth and close it several times.
Do you get angry a lot? I say.
I'm always angry, he says. Pause. Usually other things override it, but I'm always angry. And sometimes. His eyes drift vaguely to the right. Sometimes. The crowd buzzes, and I hate them even more.
What happened to you and Lucas? He asks.
I think about the phone calls that I'd been asleep for.
Oh, yeah, no, that's not, no. I didn't feel very well.
Oh, he says.
You know, I don't actually like Lucas.
Like that, I say. Okay, he says. We are silent for several long moments.
Something in his face changes.
It looks a bit like hope, but I can't really tell.
Aren't you going to criticize me? He asks.
Tell me that it's just a skating competition? That it doesn't mean anything? I ponder this.
No.
It means something.
He smiles. I would say that he looks like the original Michael again.
But he doesn't.
There's something new in the smile.
Happiness, he says, is the price of profound thought.
Who's that a quote from? I ask.
He winks. Me.
And I'm alone again in this crowd. And I feel an odd feeling. It's not happiness. I know that it's brilliant that he came second in a national qualifier. But all I can think about is how Michael is just as good at lying as I am.
Chapter 25.
We fail to find out whose house it is, but the third house from the river bridge really is right on the river. The broad garden slopes into the water, which laps persistently at the dirt. There is an old canoe tied to a tree that hasn't been used for probably centuries. And over the river, you can see right across the flat countryside. The fields, darkened under the night, blend into the horizon, as if unsure themselves quite where the earth stops and the sky begins. This meet-up is not a meet-up. It is a house party.
What had I been expecting?
I had been expecting chairs, nibbles, a speaker, perhaps a PowerPoint presentation. The evening is cold, and it keeps trying to snow. I desperately want to be in my bed, and my stomach is all tight and tense. I hate parties. I always have. I always will. It's not even for the right reasons. I hate them and I hate people who go to them. I have no justification, I'm just ridiculous. We walk past the smokers and into the open door. It's about 10 p.m. Music pounds. Clearly no one lives in this house. It's entirely bare of furniture, save for a couple of deck chairs set up in the living room and on the garden patio. And I'm aware of a kind of neutral colour scheme. The only thing giving the house any life at all is the impressive collection of artwork on the walls. There isn't any food, but there are bottles and colourful shot glasses everywhere. People are milling around in corridors and rooms, lots of them smoking cigarettes, lots of them smoking weed, very few of them sitting. Many of the girls I recognize from Higgs, though Michael does not suspect that any of these casual partygoers are the masterminds behind Solitaire. There are older kids I don't recognize. Some must be 20, if not older.
It makes me feel sort of nervous, to tell you the truth.
I don't know why I'm here. I actually see the Year 11 girl from Becky's, the one who had come as Doctor Who. She's by herself, like last time, and she looks a little lost. She's walking very slowly along the corridor, without a drink, peering sadly at this painting of a wet cobbled street with red umbrellas and warm cafe windows. I wonder what she's thinking. I imagine that it's somewhat similar to what I'm thinking. She doesn't see me. The first people we find are Becky and Lauren. I should have guessed that they would come, seeing as they attend all the parties in this town. And I really should have guessed I'd find them smashed. Becky points at us with the hand that's not clasping a bottle.
Oh my God, it's Tori and Michael, you guys!
She whacks Lauren repeatedly on the arm.
Lauren, 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 it's Sproulden!
Lauren frowns.
Mate, I thought we'd agreed on Maury or Tycho, she sighs. Man, your names just aren't good enough. Like, they don't work. They don't work like Clayne or Ramione or Destiel or Mirtha.
They both giggle uncontrollably. I start to feel even more nervous. I didn't think you guys would be interested in solitaire. Becky waves the bottle, shrugging and rolling her eyes around.
Hey, a party's a party's a party.
I don't know. Some guy.
But, like, it's solitaire. We've, like, infiltrated solitaire.
She brings her finger up to her mouth.
Shh.
She drinks from the bottle.
Listen, listen, do you know what song this is? We, like, cannot work it out.
It smells like Teen Spirit, Nirvana.
Oh, right, yeah, oh my God, I thought it was that. It does not say the song title in the lyrics.
I look at Lauren, who's gazing around her in an awed wonder. You all right, Lauren? She comes back to earth and cackles at me.
Isn't this party sick?
She raises her arms in an I don't know gesture.
It's snowing hot, guys, and the drinks are free.
That's great for you, I say, the will to be a nice person slowly drifting away. She pretends not to hear me and they walk off, laughing at nothing. Michael and I circle the party. It's not like in films or Channel 4 teen dramas where everything slows down and turns slow-mo, lights flashing, people jumping up and down with pointed hands raised. Nothing's like that in real life. People are just standing around. Michael talks to a lot of people. He asks everyone about solitaire. We run into Rita, hanging quietly with a group of girls from my year. She sees me and waves, which means that I have to say hello to her.
Hey, she says as I walk over to her. How's Charlie? Heard there was a fight or something. Ben Hope, wasn't it?
Not much stays private in a town like this, so it's hardly surprising that everyone knows.
It wasn't a fight, I say very quickly, and then clear my throat.
Yeah, he's all right. Bruised, but all right. Rita nods understandingly.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm glad he's not hurt too badly.
After that, Michael and I end up caught inside a circle of year 13s in the kitchen. Michael claims that he's never spoken to any of them.
No one knows, like, no one knows who made it, one girl says.
She has a very tight skirt on and a lot of unattractive red lipstick.
There are rumours it's some dealer from the estate or, like, a teacher who got sacked and wants revenge.
Stick around. Interrupts a guy wearing a snapback bearing the word jock.
Like, keep checking the blog, innit? I've heard things are gonna get well good when they put up the next post later.
There's a pause. I look down at the newspapered floor, which isn't doing much to protect the house from the already numerous alcohol spillages. There's a headline on one sheet reading 27 dead and a picture of a burning building.
Why? Says Michael. Why's that? But the guy just blinks, like a fish, and asks, Why aren't you drinking? I decide to be a normal person and find something proper to drink. Michael disappears for a long time, so I pick up this big old bottle from somewhere and sit alone outside on a deck chair, feeling like a middle-aged alcoholic husband. It's gone 11 and everyone's drunk. Whoever's DJing relocates to the garden, and after a while it's unclear whether I'm in some small town garden or at a Reading festival. I spot Nick and Charlie through the living room window, kissing in a corner like it's their last day on earth, despite Charlie's bruised face. I guess they look romantic, like they really are in love. I get up and go inside to look for Michael, but whatever this stuff is that's in the bottle, it's kind of strong. So next thing I know, I've lost all sense of time, space, and reality, and I have no idea what I'm doing. I find myself in the hallway again, in front of that painting of the wet cobbled street with red umbrellas and warm cafe windows. I can't stop looking at it. I force myself to turn around and spot Lucas at the other end of the corridor. I'm not sure whether he sees me, but he quickly disappears into another room. I wander away and get lost in the house. Red umbrellas, warm cafe windows. Michael grabs me out of nowhere. He pulls me away from wherever the hell I was, the kitchen maybe, lost in a sea of boy London hats and chinos, and we start to walk through the house. I don't know where we're going, but I don't try to stop him. I'm not sure why. As we're walking, I keep looking at his hand wrapped around my wrist. Maybe it's because I've had stuff to drink, or maybe it's because I'm really cold, or maybe it's because I'd sort of missed him while he'd been gone. But whatever it is, I keep thinking how nice it feels to have his hand around my wrist. Not in some weird, perverted way. His hand is just so big compared to mine. And so warm. And the way his fingers are curled around my wrist. It's like they were always supposed to do that. Like they're matching pieces in a jigsaw. I don't know. What am I talking about? Eventually, when we're outside and in the crowd of manic dancers, he slows and does a spin in the mud. It's sort of weird when he gazes at me. Again, I blame the drink. But it's different. He looks so nice standing there. His hair kind of swishing in the wrong direction and the firelight reflecting in his glasses. I think he can tell I've had a bit to drink. Will you dance with me? He shouts over the screams. I inexplicably start to cough. He rolls his eyes at me and chuckles. I start thinking about proms and weddings, and for a few seconds I actually forget that we're just in some garden where the ground looks like shit and the people are all dressed in near identical outfits. He removes his hand from my wrist and uses it to flatten his hair. And then he stares at me for what feels like a whole year. I wonder what he sees. Without warning, he grabs both of my wrists and literally kneels at my feet. Please dance with me, he says. I know that dancing is awkward and outdated, and I know that you don't like doing stuff like that, and if I'm honest, neither do I. And I know that the night isn't going to last very long, and soon everyone will just go home back to their laptops and their empty beds, and will probably be alone tomorrow, and we all have to go to school on Monday. But I just think that if you tried it, you know, dancing, you might feel for a few minutes that all of this, all of these people, none of it is really too bad. I look down and meet his eyes. I start to laugh before kneeling down too. And then I do something really weird.
Once I'm on my knees, I really can't help it. I kind of fall forward into him and fling my arms around him.
"Yes," I say into his ear.
So he puts his arms around my waist, lifts us both to our feet, and resumes pulling me through the adolescent expanses. We reach the center of the crowd clustered around the DJ. He puts his hand on my shoulders. Our faces are centimeters apart. It's so loud, he has to scream.
"Yes! Tori, they're playing the Smiths! They're playing the beautiful Smiths, Tori!"
The Smiths are the band of the internet. More specifically, and unfortunately, a band that many people listen to simply because Morrissey has that vintage, self-deprecating coolness that everyone seems to crave. If the internet were an actual country, "There Is a Light That Never Goes Out" would be its national anthem. I feel myself slightly step backward.
Do you have a blog?"
For a second, he's confused, but then he just smiles and shakes his head.
"Jesus, Tori, do I have to have a blog to like the Smiths? Is that the rule now?"
And this is the moment, I guess, when I decide that I can't care less about anything else tonight. I can't care less about blogs, or the internet, or films, or what people are wearing. And yes, I am going to have fun. I am going to have a good time. I am going to be with my one and only friend, Michael Holden, and we are going to dance until we can't even breathe, and we have to go home and face our empty beds. So when we start jumping up and down, smiling so ridiculously, looking at each other and at the sky, and not really at anything, Morrissey singing something about shyness, I really don't think things could be so bad after all.
Chapter 26. At 12:16 a.m, I go inside because if I don't pee, I think my bladder will erupt. Everyone is waiting for Solitaire's blog post, which, according to recent rumour, will be published at 12:30 a.m. People are sitting, phones in their hands. I find the bathroom, and when I leave it, I see Lucas, alone in a corner, texting. He sees me staring and jumps up, but rather than walking toward me, he quickly exits, like he's trying to avoid me. I follow him into the living room, intending to apologize for forgetting about hanging out with him today, but he doesn't see me. I watch as he wanders up to Evelyn. She is wearing these hooped earrings, chunky heels, leggings with upside-down crosses on them, and a faux fur coat. Her messy hair is piled up on the top of her head. Lucas, similarly, is in tonight's hipster get-up. A loose Joy Division t-shirt with the sleeves rolled, two tight jeans, and desert boots. Lucas says something to her, and she nods back at him. That's it, I've decided. Despite what Lucas said, they are definitely a couple. I go back outside. It has finally started to snow, properly. The music's over, but everyone's skipping around, screaming, trying to catch flakes in their mouths. I look out at the scene. The flakes float on the water and dissolve, joining with the river as it sails past me toward the sea. I love snow. Snow can make anything beautiful. It's then that I see Becky again. She's with a guy up against a tree, and I know she's definitely still drunk, because they're not even kissing romantically. I'm about to turn away, but then they move around a little, and I see who the guy is. It's Ben Hope. I don't know how long I stand there, but at some point he opens his eyes and sees me. Becky looks too. She giggles, and then she realizes.
I got a drink on my way out, but it's spilt on the snow now, and my hand is just cupping the air. They recoil from me, and then Ben hurries past me and into the house. Becky stays by the tree. She raises her eyebrows at me when I reach her and says, "What?" I wish I were dead. My hands clench and unclench. She laughs.
"What? For God's sake!"
Becky has betrayed me anyway.
Because she doesn't care.
"Everything I thought about you," I say, "is wrong."
"What are you talking about? Am I hallucinating this? Are you drunk?"
"You are a nasty bitch," I say. I think I'm shouting, but I can't really tell. I'm only 70% sure I'm saying any of this out loud.
"I used to think that you were just forgetful, but now I have solid proof that you just don't care."
"What? Don't try acting like you don't know what you've just done. Grow a backbone. Go on, try and defend yourself. I am literally dying to hear your justification.
Are you going to tell me that I don't understand?"
Becky's eyes begin to fill with tears, as if she's actually upset.
"I'm not.
That's it, isn't it? I'm your naive little friend whose sad little life makes you feel better about yourself. Well, you're absolutely spot on there. I haven't got a single clue about anything. But you know what I do know? I know when someone is being a nasty bitch. Go ahead and cry your stupid little crocodile tears if you want to. You don't fucking care at all, do you?"
Becky's voice is sober now, if a little wobbly, and she begins to shout at me. "Well, you're the one being a nasty bitch. Jesus Christ, just calm down."
I pause. This is bad. I need to stop. I can't.
"I'm sorry. Do you have any comprehension of the level of betrayal you have just committed? Do you have any concept of friendship? I didn't think it was possible for someone to be that selfish, but clearly I've been wrong all this time."
I think I'm crying.
"You've killed me. You've literally killed me."
"Calm down. Oh my God, Tori. You have solidly proven that everyone and everything is shit. Well done, Gold Star. Please delete yourself from my life." And that is it. I am gone. I am gone. I guess everyone is like this. Smiles, hugs, years together, holidays, late night confessions, tears, phone calls, 1 million words. They don't mean anything. Becky doesn't care. No one really cares. The snowfall is blurring my vision, or maybe it's the tears. I stumble back to the house, and just as I enter, people start screaming and holding their phones above their heads. I can't stop crying, but I manage to get out my phone and find the solitaire page. And there is the post.
030, 23rd of January. Solitarians, we would like you to collaborate on our latest venture. At our meetup tonight, there is a Higgs Year 12 named Ben Hope, who has deliberately injured a Truam Year 11. Ben Hope is a known homophobe and a bully, who hides behind the facade of popularity. We hope that you will join Solitaire in preventing such acts of violence in the future by giving him exactly what he deserves. Act accordingly. Protect the unprotected. Justice is everything. Patience kills. Chapter 27. There is a tornado of people around me, screaming in all directions, and I can't go anywhere. After several minutes of pandemonium, the flow steadily softens into one direction rather than a whirlpool, and I am torn out of the house in the current. Everyone is in the garden. Someone cries out, "Karma, motherfucker!"
Is this karma?
Two boys hold Ben Hope while several others hurl punches and kicks at him. Blood splatters onto the snow, and the spectacle gets wild cheers every time a hit is made. Only a few meters away, Nick and Charlie are standing in the crowd, Nick's arm around Charlie, both of their expressions unreadable. Charlie steps forward, as if he's about to intervene, but Nick pulls him back. They exchange a look and then turn away from the show. They walk out of the crowd and disappear. I couldn't stick up for Charlie, and now Solitaire's doing my job for me. I've never been able to do my job properly, I suppose. Then again, maybe this isn't about Charlie. I think back to what Michael said to me in Café Rivière. Oh, God. Maybe it's about me. I laugh, tears still falling, so hard that my stomach aches. Silly. Silly thought. Silly me. Selfish. Nothing is ever about me. Another hit. The crowd shrieks with joy, waving their drinks in the air, like they're at a concert. Like they're happy. Nobody is trying to help. Nobody. Nobody. I don't know what to do. If this were a film, I would be there. I would be the hero stopping this false justice. But this isn't a film. I am not the hero. I start to panic. I turn back into the crowd and break out through the other side. My eyes won't focus. Sirens start to blare, distant in the town. Ambulance? Police? Justice is everything. Patience kills. Michael, out of nowhere, grabs me by the shoulders. He's not looking at me. He's looking at the scene, just like the rest of the crowd, watching but doing nothing, not caring. I throw his hands off me, muttering crazily, "This is what we are. Solitaire. We could just... They just... They'll kill him. You think you've met bad people, and then you meet people who are worse. They're doing nothing. They're not... We're just as bad. We're just as bad for doing nothing. We don't care. We don't care that they could kill him." Tori. Michael takes hold of my shoulders again, but I step backward, and his arms drop. "I'll take you home." "I don't want you to take me home." "I'm your friend, Tori. This is what we do." "I don't have any friends. You are not my friend. Stop pretending that you fucking care." Before he can argue, I'm gone. I'm running. I'm out of the house. I'm out of the garden. I'm out of the world. The giants and demons are rising, and I am chasing them. I'm pretty sure I'm going to be sick. Am I hallucinating this? I am not the hero. It's funny, because it's true. I begin to laugh, or maybe I'm crying. Maybe I don't care anymore. Maybe I'm going to pass out. Maybe I'll die when I'm 27. Part 2. Donnie. "A storm is coming," Frank says. "A storm that will swallow the children, and I will deliver them from the kingdom of pain. I will deliver the children back to their doorsteps. I'll send the monsters back to the underground. I'll send them back to a place where no one else can see them. Except for me, 'cause I am Donnie Darko." Donnie Darko, The Director's Cut, 2004. Chapter 1. Lucas was a crier. It happened most days in primary school, and I think it was one of the main reasons I was his friend. I didn't mind the crying. It would come on slowly and then explode. He'd sport this odd expression for a few minutes before. Not sad, but as if he were replaying a television program in his head,
watching the events unfold. He'd look down, but not at the ground. And then the tears would start falling, always silent, never heaving. I don't think that there was a particular reason for the crying. I think that was just his personality. When he wasn't crying, we played chess or lightsaber duels or Pokemon battles. When he was crying, we'd read books. This was a time in my life when I read books. I always felt at my best when we were together. It's funny, I've never found that relationship with another person. Well, maybe Becky, in our early days. When Lucas and I left primary school, we left with the assumption that we would continue to see each other. As all those who have left primary school can guess, this never came to fruition. I saw him only once more after that time. Before now, of course. A chance meeting on the high street. I was 12. He told me that he'd sent me an Easter egg in the post. It was May. I hadn't gotten any post since my birthday. At home that evening, I wrote him a card. I said that I hoped that we could still be friends, and I gave him my email address, and I drew a picture of myself and him for good measure. I never sent that card. It stayed in the bottom of my top desk drawer for several years until I cleared out my room. When I found it, I tore it up and threw it away. I think about all these things as I'm wandering the school on Monday. I can't find him. All this time I've just been sitting around, moaning about how shit everything is, not bothering to try and make things better. I hate myself for that. I'm like all those people in the crowd at the solitaire meetup, not bothering to help. I don't think I can be like that anymore. Michael isn't anywhere to be seen either. He's probably decided to leave me alone for good now, which is fair enough. I screwed it all up again, classic Tory. Anyway, I want to talk to Lucas about Saturday. Apologize for not meeting up with him like I said I would. Tell him he doesn't have to avoid me anymore. Twice I think I see his lanky limbs swish around corridor corners, but as I run to catch him, I realize it's just another of the thin-faced sixth form boys. He's not in the common room before school, at break, or at lunch. After a while, I forget who I'm looking for, and just continue on walking forever. I check my phone several times, but there's only one message on my blog. Anonymous, thought for the day. What is the point in studying literature? Becky and our lot have not talked to me all day. Ben Hope did not go to the hospital. He wasn't anywhere near death. Some people seem to feel sorry for him, whereas others say he deserved what he got for being a homophobe. I am not sure what I think about it anymore. When Charlie and I talked about it, he seemed pretty shaken up. "This is my fault," he said, grimacing. "It's my fault that Ben was angry in the first place, so it's my fault that Solitaire..." "It's not anyone's fault," I told him, "except Solitaire's." On Tuesday, Kent keeps me back after English. Becky seems to be quietly hopeful that I'm in some kind of severe trouble, but Kent says nothing until everyone is gone. He sits on his desk, arms folded, glasses angled at a nonchalant slant.
"Tori, I think we need to talk about your Heroes of Pride and Prejudice essay. It was a very angry essay. Why did you decide to write it in that way?"
"I really hate that book."
Kent rubs his forehead.
"Yes, I got that impression."
He retrieves my essay from a cardboard folder and places it between us.
"I am sorry, Mr. Kent," he reads, but I have not read Pride and Prejudice. I disagreed with the very first sentence, and that was enough for me.
Kent looks up at me briefly before skipping to my second paragraph.
Alas, Elizabeth Bennet does not love Mr. Darcy while he is imperfect. Only once his better character is revealed does she decide that she will accept Pemberley and the 100 billion a year. Fancy that. It seems that it is impossible for the females in this novel to look past an exterior and try to dig out the greatness within others. Yes, all right, Elizabeth is prejudiced. I get it. I get it, Jane Austen. Well done.
Yeah, I say, all right.
I'm not done, chuckles Kent. He skips to my conclusion. This is why Mr. Darcy is, in my eyes, a true hero. He struggles on, despite being so harshly treated and judged. Pride and Prejudice is one man's fight to be seen by others as he sees himself. Therefore, he is not typical. A typical hero is brave, confident, and dashing. Mr. Darcy is shy, haunted by himself, and unable to fight for his own character. But he loves, and I guess that is all that matters in the world of literature.
I should be embarrassed about this, but I'm really not.
He sighs.
It's interesting that you identify with a character like Mr. Darcy.
Why?
Well, most students choose Elizabeth as the strongest character.
I look at him squarely.
Mr. Darcy has to put up with everyone hating him for reasons that aren't even true, and he doesn't even complain about it. I'd call that pretty strong.
Kent chuckles again.
Elizabeth Bennet is thought to be one of the strongest women of 19th century literature. I take it you're not a feminist.
You think I'm not a feminist because I empathise more with a male in a pretentious 19th century romantic comedy?
He smiles broadly and doesn't answer.
I shrug. It's just what I think.
He nods thoughtfully.
Well, that's fair.
Don't write so colloquially in your exam, though. You're smart, and it'll get you a bad mark.
All right. He hands me back the essay.
Listen, Tory. He scratches his chin, making a grating sound against his stubble. I've noticed that you've been quite significantly underachieving in all your AS subjects. He pauses and blinks. I mean, you were doing really very well in Year 11, especially in English.
I got a B in my sociology mock last term, I say. That's not that bad.
You've been getting Ds in English, Tory. People who get 2 A-stars in English GCSEs do not then get Ds at AS level.
Can you think of a reason for why this has happened?
He stares at me cautiously.
I suppose I don't really like school anymore.
Why is that?
It's just, I just hate being here.
My voice dies away. I look up at the classroom clock.
I need to go. I need to get to music.
He nods very slowly.
I think that a lot of people hate being here.
He turns his head to the side and glances out of the window.
But that's life, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you go on acknowledging that you hate it, you're never going to want to be here. You can't give up on it. You can't be defeatist about it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I run out the door. Chapter 2. I find Lucas by the lockers at the end of school, and this time he really cannot avoid me. He's with Evelyn and that guy with the quiff. They're all pinching their noses because Solitaire stink-bombed the entire school approximately 1 hour ago. Classic, disgusting, and unnecessary. However, most people in school today seem to be generally supportive of this particular prank. The smell in this corridor is mouldy egg. I cover my mouth and nose with my jumper. Lucas, Evelyn and Quiffguy are in conversation, serious conversation, but because I've recently turned into a rude and arrogant person, I don't give a crap that I'm going to interrupt.
"Why are you avoiding me?" I call.
Lucas nearly drops several large ring binders and stares around Evelyn's head. He moves his hand away from his nose.
"Victoria, God."
Evelyn and the guy turn and study me suspiciously before slinking away. I step toward Lucas. He's got his bag slung over his shoulder.
"Are you sure Evelyn isn't your girlfriend?" I ask, still holding my jumper over part of my face.
"What?"
he laughs nervously.
"Why do you think that?
I always see you with her.
Are you her secret boyfriend?"
He blinks several times.
No, no.
"Are you lying?"
"No."
"Are you angry because I forgot we were going to meet up on Saturday?"
"No, no, I promise I'm not."
"Then why are you avoiding me?
I haven't seen you this week."
He shoves the ring binders into the locker and withdraws a sizable art sketchbook.
"I'm not avoiding you."
"Don't lie."
He flinches.
I get it. Lucas has tried so hard since term started to be friends with me again, and I've been such an arse about it. Just because I hate making friends, I've been rude to him. I've ignored him. I've avoided him. And I haven't made a single bit of effort for him. That's me, as usual, being an utter dick to everyone for no apparent reason.
I get it. I get that I don't exactly engage with people. But since Saturday, I felt that not engaging can be just as bad as the alternative. Now Lucas doesn't seem to even want to know me.
"Look," I say, dropping my jumper, feeling desperation sink into my soul.
"We were best friends once, weren't we? I don't want you to avoid me. I'm sorry I forgot about Saturday. I forget stuff like that. But you're one of three people who I've ever been friends with, and I don't want to not talk to you anymore."
He runs a hand through his hair. It's halfway down his forehead.
I don't know what to say. "Just please tell me why you avoided me on Saturday."
Something's different. His eyes shift from side to side.
"I can't be around you."
Then quieter.
"I can't do this."
"What?" He slams the locker shut. It makes a noise that's far too loud.
"I've got to go. Just..."
But he's already walked away. I stand by his locker for a minute or so. The mouldy egg smell appears to be intensifying, as does my hatred for solitaire. Lucas forgot to lock his locker properly, so I can't resist opening it and having a look inside. There are three ring binders in there: English literature, psychology, and history, along with a bunch of sheets. I pick one up. It's a psychology sheet about coping with stress. There is a picture of a girl holding her head in both hands, a bit like that famous painting, The Scream. One of the suggestions is regular exercise, and another is writing down your problems. I replace the sheet and shut Lucas's locker. Chapter 3. Grandma and Grandad have come round, the first time in months. We're all at the dinner table, and I'm trying not to catch eyes with anyone, but I keep seeing Mum glance concernedly toward Grandad, and then glance concernedly toward Charlie. Dad's sitting between Charlie and Oliver. I'm at the head of the table.
"Your mum's told us you've got back onto the rugby team, Charlie," says Grandad.
When he talks, he leans forward like we can't hear him, even though he speaks twice as loud as everyone else.
I think that this is very stereotypical of Grandad.
It's a blessing they let you back on. You really messed them around. What, with all that time off?
Yeah, it was really nice of them, says Charlie. He's holding his knife and fork in his hands by the side of his plate.
It feels like we haven't seen Charlie for years, says Grandma. Doesn't it, Richard? Next time we see you, you'll probably have a wife and children.
Charlie forces himself to laugh politely.
Would you pass me the Parmesan, Dad? Asks Mum.
Grandad passes the Parmesan.
A rugby team always needs a skinny one like yourself. To do the running, you understand. If you'd have eaten more earlier on, you would have grown big enough to be one of the proper players. But I suppose it's too late for that now. I blame your parents, personally. More green vegetables at an early age.
You haven't told us about your Oxford trip, Dad, says Mum. I look at the plate. It's lasagna. I haven't eaten anything yet. I discreetly retrieve my phone from my pocket, and I have a message. I texted Lucas earlier.
15:23, Tory Spring. Look, I'm really, really sorry.
18:53, Lucas Ryan.
It's fine. Kiss.
19:06, Tory Spring. Quite clearly, it's not. 19:18.
I'm so sorry.
19:22, Lucas Ryan.
It's not even about that, TBH. Kiss.
19:29, Tory Spring.
Well, why are you avoiding me then?
Dad's finished his dinner, but I've been taking it slow for Charlie.
How are you getting along, Tory? Asks Grandma. Enjoying sixth form?
Yes, yeah, I smile at her. It's great.
They must treat you like adults now.
Oh, yes, yeah.
19:42, Tory Spring.
You at least need to tell me why.
And your lessons are interesting?
Yes, very.
Thought much about university?
I smile. No, not really. Grandma nods.
You should start thinking, Grandad grumbles. Important life decisions. One wrong move and you could end up in an office for the rest of your life, like me.
How's Becky? Asks Grandma. She's such a lovely girl. It would be nice if you could keep in touch when you leave.
She's fine, yeah? She's good.
Such beautiful long hair.
19:45, Lucas Ryan.
Can you meet me in town tonight? Kiss.
How about you, Charlie? Have you been thinking about sixth form, subjects-wise?
Yeah, well, I'll definitely do classics and probably English, but apart from that, I'm not really sure. Maybe PE or something? Or psychology?
Where are you going to apply?
Higgs, I think.
Higgs?
Harvey Green, Tory School.
Grandma nods.
I see. An all-girls school?
Grandad scoffs. You won't find any discipline there. A growing boy needs discipline.
My fork makes a loud noise on my plate. Grandad's eyes flicker toward me and then back at Charlie.
You've made some good, strong friends at that school. Why are you leaving them?
I'll see them outside of school.
Your friend, Nicholas, he's at Truham Sixth Form currently, is he not?
Yeah.
So you don't want to be with him?
Charlie nearly chokes on his food.
It's not that. I just think that Higgs is a better school.
Grandad shakes his head.
Education. What's that compared to friendship?
I can't take any more of this, and I'm getting much too angry, so I ask to be excused with a stomachache. As I leave, I hear Grandad say,
girl's got a weak stomach, just like her brother.
I arrive first. It's snowing again. I sit at a table outside Café Rivière. We agreed to meet at 9 p.m. and it's just gone 10:02. The street is empty and the river quiet, but a faint echo of one of those indie bands, maybe Noah and the Whale, or Fleet Foxes, or Foals, or the XX, or someone like that, I can never tell the difference anymore, is drifting out of an open window above my head. The music continues to play while I wait for Lucas. I wait until 9 p.m. Then I wait until 9:15 p.m. Then I wait until 9:30 p.m. At 10:07 p.m, my phone vibrates. 22:07, Lucas Ryan. Sorry. Kiss. I look at the message for a long time. At the single word without a full stop. At the tiny, meaningless X. I place my phone on the table and look up at the sky. The sky always seems to be lighter when it's snowing. I breathe out. A cloud of dragon breath sails above my head. Then I stand up and start to walk home. Chapter 4. In Wednesday assembly, the sixth formers spread themselves along 5 sectioned-off rows of the hall seating. You have to fill up all the gaps, otherwise not everyone will fit in the hall, so you don't get to choose where you sit. This is how I end up accidentally sitting between Rita and Becky. As people are filing into the seating rows, Ben Hope, back at school with a moderately bruised face, stares directly at me. He doesn't seem angry or scared, and he doesn't even try to ignore me. He just looked sad, like he's about to cry. Probably because he's not going to be popular anymore. I haven't seen Ben and Becky together yet, which is a sign that maybe Becky actually listened to my explosion. I think about Charlie. I wonder where Michael is. I wish Ben didn't exist. Kent's taking the assembly. He's talking about women. Most of our assemblies are about women. But I'm going to tell you the absolute truth. You, as women, are at an automatic disadvantage in the world. Becky, on my right, keeps changing which side she crosses her legs. I make a conscious effort not to move. I don't think that many of you realize how fortunate you have been so far. I start counting Kent's pauses under my breath. Becky doesn't join me. Going to the best girls' grammar school in the county is an unbelievable privilege. I can see Lucas 2 rows in front of me. He managed to catch eyes with me as he was sitting down on the way in, and I didn't bother trying to look away. I just stared. I don't even feel angry, really, about him standing me up last night. I don't feel anything. I know that many of you complain about the hard work, but until you've faced the real world, the world of work, you can't understand the meaning of hard work. Rita taps me suddenly on the knee. She holds out her hymn sheet. Underneath the lyrics, "To love, shine a light," she has written, "You're isolating yourself. You are going to face a phenomenal shock once you leave this school. This school where all are treated as equals." I read it several times, then study Rita. She's just someone I know. I'm not really friends with her. "You are going to have to work harder than men to get to where you want to be. That is the simple truth." She shrugs at me.
Therefore, I hope that while you're at this school, you'll think about and be appreciative of what you've got. You are all very lucky. You have the potential to do anything you want to do and to be anything you want to be. I fold up the hymn sheet into a paper plane, but I don't fly it because you can't do that in assembly. Everyone stands and sings Love Shine a Light, and the lyrics nearly make me laugh out loud. On my way out, I drop the paper plane discreetly into Becky's blazer pocket. I don't sit with anyone at lunch. I end up not having any lunch, actually, but I don't mind. I walk around the school. At many points during the day, I wonder where Michael could be. But at other times, I'm fairly sure that I don't care. I haven't seen Michael all week. I have been thinking a lot about his skating. National Youth Semifinals. I wonder why he didn't tell me about it. I wonder why he isn't here. I'm sitting against the tennis courts, surrounded by seagulls, which is odd, because they should have migrated by now. It's period five. Music. I always skip Wednesday period five, because that is our performance practice lesson. I am watching as every girl in year seven makes her way out of the main school building and onto the field. Some running, most laughing, and each with a collection of party poppers in her hands. I can't see any teachers. I don't know what Solitaire has said to year seven, but it is clear to me that this is its doing. I take out my phone and load up Google. I type in Michael Holden. And then I type in the name of our town. Then I press enter. Like magic, my Michael Holden appears in the search results. The first result is an article from our county newspaper entitled, Local Teen Wins National Speed Skating Championship. I click on it. It takes a while to load. My knees start to bob up and down in anticipation. Sometimes I hate the internet. The article is about 3 years old. There is an accompanying picture of 15-year-old Michael, but he doesn't look so very different. Maybe his face is a little less defined. Maybe his hair is a little longer. Maybe he's not quite so tall. In the picture, he is standing on a podium with a trophy and a bunch of flowers. He is smiling. Local teen Michael Holden has skated to victory at this year's National Under-16 Speed Skating Championships. Holden's previous victories include Regional Under-12 Champion, Regional Under-14 Champion, and National Under-14 Champion. The head of the UK's Speed Skating Authority, Mr. John Lincoln, has spoken out in response to Holden's undeniably extraordinary run of victories. Lincoln claimed, "We have found a future international competitor." Holden clearly displays the commitment, experience, drive, and talent to bring the UK to victory in a sport that has never received satisfactory attention in this country. I head back to the search results page. There are many more articles of a similar nature. Michael won the under-18 championships last year. I guess this is why he was angry when he came second in the semi-final. And fair enough. I think I would be angry if I were him. I sit there, staring at Google for some time. I wonder whether I feel starstruck. But I don't think that's really it. It just seems momentarily impossible for Michael to have this spectacular life that I don't know about. A life where he's not simply running around with a smile on his face, doing stuff that has no point. It's so easy to assume you know everything about a person. I click off my phone and lean back against the wire fence. The year sevens have now congregated. A teacher runs out of school toward them, but she's too late. The year sevens shout a countdown from 10, and then they lift their party poppers into the air and let loose, and it sounds like I've wandered onto a World War II battlefield. Soon everyone is screaming and jumping, the streamers spiraling through the air like some crazy rainbow hurricane. Other teachers begin to show, also screaming.